in every society, there are some places that have specialness to them, sacredness and connection to something bigger than the everyday. And I think the museums are places that do that and have that kind of charge.
There are many kinds of museums. From the supersized Smithsonian to the childhood home of Muhammad Ali, from Bangkok to Boston and everywhere in between. But museum goers only see part of the full picture. On this show, we open the crates, tell the stories, meet the people, and reveal the inner workings, unseen, unheard, until now. From Philbrook Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential.
Hey, this is Scott Gregory sitting in today for Jeff Martin. Maybe museum directors are a little like U.S. presidents. They often serve for around 4 or 8 years. Some make big impacts and change the course of history in both good and bad ways. But many are forgotten and are not worthy of whatever the museum equivalent of Mount Rushmore might be. However, for the past 10 years, Adam Lerner was at the helm of MCA Denver. His impact on that institution and the city, and in many ways the industry, is undeniable. Adam recently stepped down to explore new adventures, and before he left MCA Denver, we were asked to come and do a sort of exit interview with Adam before he took his leave. And here is that conversation, our host Jeff Martin with Adam Lerner, recorded live in Denver a few weeks ago.
We're calling this an exit interview, and that's a very kind of job-specific way of describing this. But I wanted to kind of jump back 10 years ago. Do you remember something from your interview to get this job, or what some of the process was like, some interesting moment that happened when you actually became director or were applying to become director?
Yeah, I actually, I do in a totally embarrassing way, because I was actually just looking over the presentation I gave at my interview. First of all, like, how weird is it to give a presentation at an interview? Like, I did that.
Like a PowerPoint presentation?
Yeah, like I gave
it. There was an actual PowerPoint presentation at your job interview. Okay.
Yeah. And I said, can I give you a PowerPoint? I think it's just because, you know, I'm just so comfortable talking with images that, like, do you mind if I just give a presentation? But I was looking it over, and what I set up in that interview, in that presentation, was, again, this is a little bit embarrassing, like exactly the same stuff I talk about like now at the museum. Like, it's the exact same formula. Basically, I said, you know, it begins with how to build an institution, but it becomes how to build a city. And it was actually like, wow, like that was really smart. Like, I wish I would have remembered that I thought about that like 10 years ago, because that's exactly the stuff I talk about like now. And that's exactly the vision I have for the museum. And I, of course, what's amazing is I talk about it as if I'm just thinking it up. Of course, I said that in my interview.
If that's the same stuff that you've stayed on message for the last 10 years from that presentation to now, does that mean you kind of had a big idea of what you wanted to do with the museum rather than just the philosophical stuff that you believe as an individual? But did you see the big moves and things that you wanted to do at that time, or did you have to kind of get into it and mix it up to really see the opportunities that were there?
Yeah. No, I had to definitely get in to see it, to feel it, and it took me a while to figure it out. But philosophically, it's an important distinction, because I think that most of, or at least many of my colleagues talk about how to make a great museum, and I've always thought about the museum as a kind of like a battery, like some sort of like energy source for the city. So it's like, how do we create energy in a city that's sort of creative energy, that's that inspires people to be more interesting people, that helps them think about differently about what it means to live in that city. And so that philosophical, like, that overlay, you know, informed how I read everything that happened around me. And so, like, I really always saw in terms of energy, like, mostly what is blocking the energy right now between the energy around us in the city and, like, what's happening inside our walls as a museum.
I mean, I've heard people describe museums as saying, you know, the best ones are known for what they do rather than what they are, right? And when you have a big idea like that, like saying, I want to bring a certain energy to the city, I want to impact the city, it's very easy to say something like that. But how do you even begin doing it? That's a very hard thing to put into an actual action.
Sure. Well, it's very difficult because, in fact, there's huge barriers. Because as Denver is growing rapidly, it's not necessarily obvious that the museum, which is right at the center of a lot of that growth, is going to be a part of that forward movement of the city. And I think that the most important thing is we have to sort of decrease the membrane outside the museum. Like, that basically we had to sort of let whatever energy is happening outside, like, I don't know what the science is here, is it osmosis? But, like, come inside too, through that membrane. So that you kind of equalize those two a little bit more. And that meant actually to become a lot less stuffy, most importantly, to be able to sort of think of ourselves as being creative in the same way that restaurateurs are creative, that DIY spaces are creative, that really awesome retail shops are creative. And we had to sort of align ourselves with that kind of the energy that makes cities interesting. And we did that by sort of not being so focused on, well, this is a very important artist that we need to tell you about. Like, no, we need to sort of have that important artist, but of course it's going to be an important artist. That's just the baseline. What's really interesting is what we do around that, and what kind of place are we. And we very specifically wanted to speak a language that connected with the language of the most interesting stuff that happens in cities.
When you're trying to do something like that, and I would imagine you've run into this a lot, there's a term you hear from people who are scared of change, especially institutionally, and that term is mission creep. You guys all know this term, mission creep, right? So the idea being that you're getting far outside of your boundaries of what a museum can be, what a museum director is supposed to do, what a curator is supposed to do, anyone fill in the blank. Have you encountered that resistance in any way, not just in this job, but through your career? Because you kind of straddle so many different things, of course, curatorially, director, but there's a programmer in you as well, and there's all these different things. And how do you kind of fight back against something like that?
I'm so beyond creeping. Like, I'm like mission leaping.
Mission leap is a good word.
Like mission way behind. I'm like, it's like, where, what, mission? Oh, yeah, mission's like ancient history. Yeah, no. To me, it's never been a criticism, because I got right out in front of that issue and said, actually, I think that what's most interesting about what's happening in the world today is that the very definition of artist is changing in a way it hasn't in hundreds of years. So therefore, you have right now in our culture people who are really interesting chefs who model themselves after artists. That's what the whole artisanal culture is. That's why retailers talk about curating, right? Because everybody is modeling themselves after artists. And you have, if you like on Instagram, look at hashtag art, probably 99% of what you see is not just not shown in museums, but not even considered art by people who work in art museums. And that's a crazy situation that we live in today, where most institutions have a definition of art that is completely misaligned with what the population that they serve thinks about as art. So I went right ahead and faced that issue head on, and we would do programming here like Art Meets Beast, which is a 3-day event where we took a bison that had been slaughtered just 3 weeks earlier from a nearby ranch, or wherever bison start off at. we brought it into the gallery, and we had an artisan butchering it and talking about the different parts of the animal and the architecture, literally a design of the animal. And then the chefs are there, and the chefs are looking at the animal and the design of the animal and how that relates to the different qualities of the properties of the different parts of it. And then over the course of 2 days, we had talks about the relationship between art and food and design, including all the designs associated with animal husbandry all the way through to restaurant design. And then we had all the chefs make a meal out of the bison, and everybody ate it. And I really am interested in connecting that aspect of art that is, you know, on a pedestal or in a frame with the aspect of what I think I really care about more importantly, which is civilization. Like, what is our, how is what we see in a frame connected to our culture, to who we are as a people? And so therefore, I was, yes, you can call that mission creep, but I think that the mission of art museums is completely outdated to what our culture is. And I think that one thing a museum of contemporary art should do, it should be in a place that experiments with what the future of art is becoming. I think in 50 years from now, the art that we're going to see in museums, in art museums, is not even going to be recognizable to us today as art. Like, it might be HBO, you know, series that we see in art museums. Whatever it is, I don't know, but it's not going to be like what we are seeing on the walls today.
And are you totally judgment-free about that? Do you have any opinion on whether that's good or bad or anything? If it does become HBO, what do you think about that?
Well, I think that our job as art museums, especially contemporary museums, think of themselves as avant-garde, right? Because the art they show, you know, has a history that is avant-garde. But actually, what those people are doing is something that I would see as rear-guard. What they're doing is defending a tradition of art. And I believe that one of our jobs is to defend, as a museum, is to defend a tradition of art and to say that there is something that happens actually in the process of education and compounding of knowledge over centuries that produces something interesting, that produces art that could not probably have been produced outside of that tradition. And institutions and the critical press and all the little writers and who write, you know, diligently about it, like, they're actually raising the stakes in a way that actually matters and it produces something interesting. And I believe in that, and I always have been. On the other hand, I believe that that can be stultifying sometimes, and that can actually start to kind of eat its own tail, like an art that is relevant only if you know the rules of that world. And if you don't, then it's like not, it doesn't make any sense to you. And I believe that when tradition is changing, that it's really our job to explore what is the outside of that. What is the outside of art? And I would say that's just interesting. And there's just energy in that. So I do believe in the tradition, but I also believe in the exploration outside that.
I heard you once say, maybe in a talk somewhere, and I'm going to paraphrase you slightly, but here, and you said something along the lines of, you weren't religious enough as a young person to become a rabbi, but you found solace and challenge in the bigger ideas posed by contemporary art, something along those lines. Yeah. Do you still feel that way? Meaning, are you still as excited and challenged and invigorated by the art world, contemporary art, as you were when you were kind of coming into your own at that period?
Yes. And you know what, though? I believe that one of the reasons that I do things that go outside the art world is, it might seem strange, but it's because I believe in art so much. I don't just have a professional relationship to art, like a curatorial relationship to it. Like, I believe that art is this kind of world where we've all agreed in a kind of mythology. We agree that what's in this that we call a gallery as opposed to just room, right? That what's in this gallery actually has some value, that has some charge to it that is different from what's in another room that is just called room. And what's in this building is different, it has a different charge to it. And I believe that there's a kind of magic to that, a mythology that we are the bearers of a tradition, a sacred element of our culture, and that And then in many ways, our artists are the ones who are bearing this place of specialness. Like where other in every society, there are some places that have specialness to them, sacredness and connection to something bigger than the everyday. And I think the museums are places that do that and have that kind of charge. And precisely because I believe in like the social role of museums, that's also why I believe it's much more than just about the field of like, is this a good work of art? It's about who is doing those things that are disrupting and making alterations in the fabric of our society in interesting ways. And that's like, and to me, those two are very much aligned. Like my belief in art, you can say, is the flip side of my skepticism about the rigid definitions of art.
We had a call before the show, and I said, you know, I don't want to just talk about all the highlights. I want to talk a little bit about some failures as well. And Adam said, that's fine. We can talk about that. But just so you know, we haven't had any failures. And I do want to dive into that in a second. But before I do that, we're going to take a quick break to hear a word from our sponsor for today.
Today's episode of Museum Confidential is brought to you by Killing Time. Killing Time is not the name of yet another ultra-violent video game. What we're really talking about here is the age-old activity of just, you know, killing time. We've all done it, walking around, looking around, the precursor to the more widely accepted notion of hanging out. Killing Time has actually been bringing visitors to museums for as long as museums have been around. Very few places offer the opportunity to both walk around and look around so purposefully. Long layover for that transatlantic flight? Head over to the museum. Water's off at the house because some construction workers hit a line, hit up the galleries. When it comes to killing time, no one is killing it as much as museums.
When we talked about the concept of things that haven't worked or failures, and you had kind of said, well, we don't have them, I wonder if you were speaking because you view experimentation and trying new things in a way that failure is just not something that you put into the mix. Like, what do you mean by that? Because, of course, some things bring out 100 people when you want 500, and some, you know, there are metrics to things in terms of success. But what do you mean by that?
I was kind of joking.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, because we fail all the time.
Yeah.
So,
but I think there was something behind that in the sense of, do you embrace trying new things so much so that you don't think of it that
Sure. way? But I really want to pursue that because there's lots of examples of failure that I could give you that are just ordinary everyday failure that, okay. So for example, the first 4 years I was here, I don't think I hit a fundraising goal any of those years. Our attendance was like plateaued to declining. And I think that there's so many examples of us trying to achieve any normal metrics, you know, that we don't, you know, hit. Those would be like normal failures. Those are not actually as interesting to me as like the really big, scary failures that are more personal, because like some of them, which relate to what allowed me to do the most interesting things I've done. So for example, when I came up with the idea for Mixed Taste, the program is very simple. You have one speaker speak on one subject for 20 minutes, and then you have a second speaker speak on a completely unrelated subject for 20 minutes, and then you have question and answer of both at the same time. Now, I was an academic, I had a PhD, I thought I was going to be a professor, and like many curators entering the field, I cared a lot about my reputation, in like intellectual reputation. So the thing that I feared most was that people would not take me seriously. And now here I created a program in a shopping district. You know, it's called, you know, T.S. Eliot and Fresh Meat Sausage. And I was scared that people wouldn't take me seriously. I took all of my colleagues and my dissertation advisor off of the mailing list on that first time that we sent out the postcards. And it was because I was, like, for me, what really was failure was not that no one would show up. You could have 100 people in the audience, and I would think I was a failure because my colleagues thought that I was ridiculous, right?
And but was all that based on assumption? Did anything ever make that manifest
in
any real way?
Of course. And the way that happens is it always happens. So, like, for example, I create this institution at this shopping district in the suburbs, and I go to we're about to open the new building in 2006, and I go to an interview with New York media, and I tell them, like, well, I've got this program where we try to break existing patterns of thinking, and I'm giving all the philosophy behind it. And they're like thinking, like, oh, this poor guy from Denver doesn't know, you know, how a museum's supposed to run. And so the reporter says to me, so do you do artist lectures? Like, helping me out? Like, you know, know that museums are supposed to do artist talks? And, like, talks about the history of art? Like, you know, because that's really what museums should do. And so, like, all of a sudden, I'm like, oh, my God, I'm not being taken seriously.
What did that feel like?
I felt a lot of things at the same time, right? I mean, one thing is, like, oh, this is what it feels like when you're not taken seriously. Like, oh, this it hurts.
It was just hitting the thing that you feared most.
Totally, totally. And so it hurt, and, of course, like, it was devastating because when you fly from Denver to New York and to, like, talk about the awesome things that you think you're doing, and then this reporter says, like, oh, clearly you don't know what you're supposed to be doing. Well, then, even though I know that reporter was completely narrow and a very conventional idea, there's still a part of me that was devastated that I wasn't being taken seriously. But then what ends up happening is that, and this is probably the reason why I could say that really wasn't a failure, because, like, I got better and better at understanding what that felt like. I got better and better at knowing what it feels like when exactly the thing that I fear happens, and that's actually a good thing, and that's a sign that actually it's going well. And so, for example, the most interesting exhibition I've done, which was I did the retrospective for Mark Mothersbaugh.
Of Devo.
Right, exactly. He was the co-founder of the band Devo, right? A band with the funny red hats. You know, whip it good. And I believe that Mark Mothersbaugh, in the course of researching him, came to be even more convinced that he is not just an important artist, but one of the most important cultural forces of the last 50 years in this country. And I wrote the book and did the exhibition to be able to demonstrate that. And my biggest fear there was that people would think that this is just an audience grab. Oh, this guy, Mark Mothersbaugh, he was in a band, he's popular. And therefore, there's a museum that's just trying to do that. And therefore, again, it's ultimately the fear of not being taken seriously, right? That I'm just like a marketing hack, a museum hack, right? And so, well, it turns out that after the exhibition opened, I felt redeemed, I should say, by the time the exhibition opened, because the night before, I would walk through the galleries, and it looked really impressive. And I felt convinced, oh my God, this is the real deal. And I knew it. I felt completely, at that point, for the first time, I actually felt like, okay, I don't have to be worried anymore. Like, for the first time in the 3 years of the research on this exhibition, that, like, yes, this is good and serious and important and funny and amazing. But then again, you know, pretty soon after that, I went to an art fair, and I won't name any names here, where I was sitting in a bar next to a curator at a major museum in the middle of America. And they're like, what are you working on? I said, well, we just opened this exhibition of Mark Mothersbaugh. Who's that? Oh, I said, the co-founder of the band Devo. And he said, probably not even thinking that he was being a total jerk, but he said, oh, you know, museums, yes, you know, they're doing a lot of things now to try to reach audiences, to try to, like, you know, do a lot of pop culture things. And it was like, oh, that's exactly the thing that I feared that other people would say about it. And it was so it hurts. Yeah, it was like it stung.
But you did it anyway. And I guess if you know that's going to happen, and it will. I mean, you're kind of setting yourself up for the inevitable, because that will happen. The key is, of course, it's not the majority opinion, it's the minority opinion. But when you do that, you obviously aren't scared of it enough to keep you from doing it, right? You still did it. So these fears of, you know, inadequacy or whatever they are not borne out by you stopping in any way.
Yeah, in fact, the opposite. What I'd learned by what Mixed Taste had taught me when I went to that reporter in New York with my best idea, so proud to explain, and was completely dismissed, and still knew that it was my best idea. And probably because it was dismissed because it was so different than anything I knew. Oh yeah, I actually started to look for those things that scared me. I started to try to do the things that actually felt like, where like feel that like hardening in my chest, like where I'd feel like, oh my God, like, am I gonna be, are people gonna think I'm ridiculous for doing this? That's the only thing that actually started to interest me, is to do those things that really challenged me. And that's where I felt like I was doing things that are most interesting. That's why, like my last exhibition I did for the museum, I still felt that even up until the last night before the exhibition opened, it was a tattoo artist, Amanda Wachup. And up until the night before the opening, I'm like, is this totally crazy? Here's an artist who's never been exhibited before in a contemporary art museum, just as Mark Mothersbaugh had never been exhibited before in a museum. And I felt like legitimately scared like every other time, and then felt redeemed.
That seems like you function best when there's a little bit of scared happening.
Yeah.
Is there a little bit of scared happening now that you're leaving the museum?
Yes, definitely. I am, and that's actually like in many ways, like, thank you for pointing that out, because I feel like maybe that's like one reason why it feels like important for me to leave the museum field, for at least for now, because I want to walk into a territory that I don't know what it will offer me.
And when you say walk away from the museum field, is that something that was a desire? You know, when did you start kind of getting the sense of an ending here?
Yeah. I don't know. I had always a sense that the museum was, for me, like a found object. Like, I was an artist who had given a found object to work with, like a car door, you know, and I'd like make a sculpture out of this car door. And I was like, my job is to like, okay, I got this museum here. I'm going to make something out of it. And so I was always treated it like it's a material for me to work with and do manipulate while keeping it. And so therefore, at some point, it started to feel like, okay, maybe I've done the interesting things that I've got within me to do with this material that I was given. So I never came to the museum field like, I'm a museum person, I'm a museum director. I always came to it as, this is a really, really interesting vehicle to work with, a really interesting... like, because museum, it's got a magic to it, right? And so therefore, for me, like maybe about a year ago or so, when I started to like realize like, okay, I love this job. I'm still in the job. I like the job. I like the museum. I love the museum. I just feel like the most interesting thing I've got in me next is probably not going to be from the seat of a museum director.
Cadillac Ranch is the perfect mix of roadside attraction and iconic art installation. It's definitely a must-see if you find yourself in the Texas Panhandle, traveling on the old Route 66 outside Amarillo. 10 classic automobiles stick up from the earth like some sort of American Stonehenge. It was recently reported that the oldest Cadillac of the 10 was burned in an act of apparent arson, set on fire. The day after the fire, the following statement was posted to the official Cadillac Ranch Facebook page. Quote, though we're heartbroken by this act of vandalism and the layers of history that were so carelessly destroyed, fortunately, the structural integrity of the Cadillac is still sound. When all is said and done, the Cadillac Ranch still stands as a testament to time, beauty, art, and history, despite the callous attempts to erase it. Much like their West Texas home, these Cadillacs are iconic for their strength. Through adversity, drought, wind, and fire, they remain standing through the decades. End quote.
That's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. To learn more about what's going on at the museum and at the station, visit philbrook.org or publicradiotulsa.org, or both. We suggest both. Until next time, look closer.